Hello. You're now listening to the Modum Podcast, where we deconstruct, examine, and discuss deeply technical data networking and information technology topics. Sit back and relax while we fire up Dial D and the 9600 baud modem and connect to the Wildcat BBS.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Modum Podcast, where we are going to do what's called a stop and chat. A stop and chat? What's that? Well, it's a new thing we're going to try out where we stop and we, well, chat. Today with me, I'm Chris Cummings, obviously. We got Nick Baraglio, John Osman, and our stop and chat guest, Nick Campbell. So, Nick, you start off first. Who the hell are you?
My name's Nick Campbell. I'm a principal solutions architect with a company called i9 Technologies out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. We are a systems integrator and historically have been working behind the scenes, working through that. Recently, been working a lot with rural communities, building emergency wireless networks during COVID, and now working towards sustainable internet connections to their community and homes.
Very cool. And for clarity, we're going to call you Nick too, since old Nick came first. Old Nick, talk to me, man.
Am I really that old? I think I am, actually, yeah, at this point.
I think it counts.
How's it going? I'm Nick Baraglio. Everyone that has ever listened to this should probably know who I am. I'm loud and obnoxious and lots of opinions.
Is that the truth? Mr. John, how are you? It's been a while since you've been on.
It has been. I'm very fortunate we saw this today, and I'm very fortunate to have been able to work with Nick, too, on a couple of projects here and there. Been a lot of fun. They're doing some great work, and I want to see how I can help them out and see what else we can do with this community here. What do we have today?
Yeah. What are you even working on, Nick? What's like a cool project? I know we were kind of chatting offline, and you'd mentioned all sorts of stuff with like Microtik, which has immediately got Nick and I salivating. But Microtik, I think you mentioned MACsec. Maybe talk about what you're doing there.
Yeah, so we've got an enterprise customer been working with that as a kind of an OPEX cost savings measure. We're getting multiple internet connections, but they're at two different sites and looking at ways that we can secure the fiber link between them as an audit requirements requiring encryption across any site-to-site connection. And just from general business practice, not needing to increase size and capacity of their existing firewall and routing infrastructure. So was looking to deploy some Microtik CCRs, the 2004 series or the 2116s with those new ARM processors across that. As we do know with InsideRouter OS 7, they did add MACsec support. So I haven't had a chance to fully model that in terms of throughput and performance on that, but that is something we're looking to be able to do and test to see what the performance looks like with that, though always being able to fail back to like an EO MPLS across the Microticks with MACsec between our the core switches that are at each site. So definitely something that kind of piqued our interest, as we've all been aware, we go into a sales process with a vendor and give them all of our requirements. They give us a recommendation. And then after you purchase it and go to install and configure, you start finding out the feature sets that to do what you need to do are not included in the product they sold you. And so then you have to kind of re-architect on the fly kind of what you're doing to meet the end customer requirements that have been brought up. So that's kind of one of the big things we're working on there. Ultimately, I think it'll actually, bring a little ISP work down to the enterprise, doing multi-site, multi-home BGP, and then doing interior routing between those locations in order to provide active failover between the sites and be able to provide a better quality of service for the end users as the one site near the main office is on the same provider that most of the home users have at home. So by far, that gives us the shortest path and lowest latency for those remote workers connecting in to then be able to pipe that back over to the data center. So
that's a pretty big deal, but I want to go back to the first thing we talked about a little bit. So you mentioned MACsec. I think we should probably define what that is. We'll tease that apart a little bit because it's not just a Microtik thing, right? It's a IEEE standard. I think it's like 802.1A or something like that. And let's go into a little bit of what that is, because people may not know. So let's take that apart.
So MACSEC being media access control security, it is basically a layer two encryption protocol. You know, we're all probably familiar with the IPsec standard that, you know, has been deployed, you know, synonymously through everything. We're seeing a lot in enterprises under audits, you know, the requirement for the encryption. And we're starting to see some auditors, specifically more insurance auditors than compliance auditors, that MPLS is not a secure connection. So, you know, how do we design and build the networks around that, though, you know, having the ability to offload MACSEC, as we tend to see it a lot in enterprise on core switching gear, MACSEC support, you know, and some of the larger routing platforms had options for line cards that support MACSEC and ASICs. But that's kind of a big thing, is, you know, fully offloading your encryption to ASICs and being able to link, you know, your layer three switches or routers across an encrypted connection at line rate is a big thing that we're having that ability. And of course, because it is a layer two encryption protocol, we can run all of the rest of our stack above that, you know, layer two, layer three, and beyond across those connections to kind of link the sites as needed for that. And we're seeing even in some, you know, driven enterprise markets to where they're actually even utilizing MACSEC between hosts and core as well, to ensure that, you know, the entire, including your network broadcast traffic, you know, isn't able to be picked up and decrypted across that. So, you know, historically it's been switch to switch, but we are starting to see more need for it between host devices and the switch layer as well.
Yeah, I could see that. So it's basically, it provides a layer two encryption mechanism between two endpoints. So it essentially gives you a protected, I don't want to call it a circuit, but a protected path between two devices that will then obfuscate or encrypt LDP, ARP, NDP, all of those link layer and layer two protocols. I could see that being useful in, you know, such environments. Say you're buying a managed service, right? So you've got a data center, and the only way to get connectivity to it is either you buy transit from the transit provider, or you buy transport from a transport provider. It might be the same provider. So you want to get from point A to some carrier hotel, but you don't know what's in between, right? So you put a device on either end of that layer two, and you run MACSEC in between them, and they are none the wiser. So it basically provides a layer two version of what is traditionally VPN overlay, like you said, like IPsec.
Now, correct. I have a question for those of you that are smarter than me about MACSEC. Does it allow you to go over other layer two hops, or do you need to be adjacent from a layer two standpoint to others? Because I have heard that there's like some Cisco proprietary like MACSEC extensions that let you like actually go over a switched network, whereas other ones, like, I guess, I don't know. Actually, I don't even know if MACSEC is standard or not. I've really not looked into it too much, but it requires you to be directly connected, and you basically have to be physical layer connected or over like an optical wavelength or something.
It's an IEEE standard.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yes. Historically, it has been a device to device. So even like, say, if you had other layer twos, like, LACP or lag groups between switches, you would actually configure MACSEC on each individual physical port that makes up that group in order to do that. You know, Cisco does have kind of that multi-hop capability with inside their extensions, which was not part of the standard. This is where things of like EOV, MPLS, as long as your upstream CEs are not stripping the header, you know, stripping or modifying the packets in that, you should be able to actually run MACSEC across an EOMPLS circuit, as that should be transparent to the switches that they are connected across there. So there is still some interop that you have to do with layer two tunneling protocols between your upstreams. But if it is a true transparent layer two, like an EOMPLS should be, you should be able to establish MACSEC across that very easily.
So I think,
I have Chris, like two, Go ahead, Nick.
So I was just going to give up a data point. So I think when we had looked at some of this stuff where we work years ago, you could do MACSEC over an E-pipe, which is essentially like a VLL or a pseudo wire, depending on your vendor nomenclature, but you couldn't do it over a VPLS with Mac learning. And that was on a very specific vendor that will remain unnamed, but it may be different now, but I'm pretty sure that that's still the case, which is kind of makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Because if there's Mac learning in the middle, it kind of gets strange.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cool stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So it's definitely kind of a, you know, there's no like set standard. Hey, you have to have these specific ones and it'll just work. There is going to be some interop, you know, especially between the providers that you're using for that circuit. But it definitely is a great ability to link, you know, or add encryption to some of the legacy MPLS without having to add the additional overhead of, you know, IPsec across that, since, you know, most enterprise providers on their core switches don't really support IPsec, at least in an offloaded perspective. So you really start to hit throughput limitations. Though most of your Broadcom chipsets and custom ASICs from your big vendors tend to support MACSEC in hardware, as long as you order it specifically for that. So they'll have the offloading capability to do that encryption at line rate and transparent to whatever other data traffic that you're passing across that circuit. So.
And suddenly thinking about various, you know, various protocols being used to push Mac frames around. If some of them are not direct, you know, look at the VPLS side. I mean, are we going to start running into providers that we're going to have to choose which provider we use for Ethernet transport based on whether or not they can, you know, they're actually clear enough to send, you know, the MACSEC or not? It'll be an interesting thing to sit and watch for a bit.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Cause like as a provider, sometimes you're like, ooh, you know, I don't run dumb things over my network, or, but like there, I've definitely heard of providers doing that. I'm like, ooh, don't do it that way. They all talk just like that too. But yeah, I mean, I think if you do want to stand out as a provider, yeah, old Nick's laughing at me. Yeah. If you want to stand out as a provider, like you do need to make sure that you're being as transparent as possible, because like that's your value add in my book, is don't get in the way. And the second you start getting in the way, like get in front of it, not that it's brand new technology or anything, but like get in front of this by making sure that you are providing transparent, you know, services when you say you are. Because I cannot tell you the number of times I've ordered like a tail circuit or something from a provider and they're like, oh, well, we have a switch in the middle here. I'm like, yeah, well, don't.
That's super common, dude. Super common where you got MTU clamping and stuff because, oh, that's a Q&Q. We didn't tell you that or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll run into weird problems. Like that's really prevalent in the transport, layer two transport space. So folks, if you're ordering a layer two transport circuit, make sure you ask for, well, if it was me, I would ask for jumbo frames, you know, 9,000 byte frames. Well, which
and I think most that of them goes will into, all
have, but ask anyway.
Well, and I think that kind of goes into what we were talking about earlier, too, about, you know, OEOs. And, you know, when you're ordering a layer two circuit is, you know, are they throwing switchgear in the middle? Or is it truly OEO? Because, you know, they say it's transparent, it's going through switchgear, but then you run into stuff like that, like MTU clamping and all the other kind of, you know, standard, you know, switch configs that they may be doing on that versus just a very traditional, you know, transponder, muxponder, OEO configuration on those circuits. You know, I don't want anything in the middle. If I'm getting a circuit, I want to be able to, you know, choose, yes, I still have to negotiate my handoff from the provider into that OEO, whether that be Ethernet, fiber channel, you know, whatever that, but, you know, I don't want you to have any influence on any of my traffic passing through there.
Yeah, well, even higher up the stack, even. What happens when we run into things that, you know, actually pass layer two, but won't necessarily pass, some, not broadcast or any cast, but, you know, some of the multicast stuff that suddenly it's, you know, it's like, yeah, this works as Ethernet, but why can't I get an OSPF adjacency or something like that? And
yep,
the things people are expecting to happen and can't because what the underlying, you know, the underlay is actually doing.
As our frequent co-host says, it's always MTU unless it's DNS.
It is. This all this talk of all this talk of chaining together switches and stuff for optical, electrical, and like just all of the crazy things you get in Tales of Arcadia. So it reminds me of a bit of a war story I have, which is this circuit I had in the middle of nowhere. Location will remain undisclosed, but it was a, you know, internet circuit, private, you know, layer 3 VPN provided by one of the big telcos. And of course, like most things, when it's out in the middle of nowhere, they don't actually have fiber there. So they are getting last mile delivered by somebody else. Well, because they're such a big organization, let's call them Cumin, they have, you know, subcontracted most of their last mile for these locations out to like just like a known provider who they always work with. And then that provider often goes and subs out again. And sometimes they go and sub that out again. So I did have one location at a former life that had, I don't remember exactly how, it was at least 3 NIDs on the wall, just like daisy chained together, plugged in one to another from the person actually providing the circuit to the person reselling the provided circuit to the person reselling the provided circuit. And then Cumin had their, you know, circuit on the very end, their NID on the very end of the circuit, so that everybody could guarantee, you know, that everything was working great. But yet when it broke, which shockingly it did all the time, they never could figure out what was going on. And I'll never forget waiting multiple months just to get a single NID replaced. And it was fantastic.
Yeah. Let's go back to one of the terms that was used earlier, because people may not understand. And we went real fast into optical networking, and that's a bit of a black box for most folks, I think. There's not a lot of people that get their hands on DWDM, you know, wave multiplexing gear. But you said OEO, and I just wanted to define that. So OEO is an optical, electrical, optical handoff. So essentially, if you have, you know, an optical network that is, you know, let's say it's a bunch of wavelengths that you're transporting, 800 miles or whatever, 1,000 miles, there's going to be different sections in there where it has to be broken out to an electrical signal to be amplified. Or if you want to do what's called a, oh gosh, well, I just said it 5-10 minutes ago, where you're handing off a service to somebody. So you want to hand off 10 gig along the way, right? You have to OEO it in specific locations along that path. This is a very dumbed down version of sort of how it happens. But I wanted to define that just because we threw some terms out there that people may not know. Chris or John or other Nick, if you've got a better way to define that, you know, feel free to correct me there. But I did want to go ahead and just throw that out as a definition.
Yeah, so a big thing with OEO is that it's not really specific to a vendor or really a protocol at that point. You can leverage, you know, standard Ethernet. You could do optical carrier across that. I've even seen some instances of, you know, digital SDI across those muxponders being able to actually, you know, convert that. It really is doing just that. Oftentimes you'll see them in a network in an ad drop like you were describing as a mid-span.
Drop.
Where they'll, you know. So you have ad drops, and then they usually have those in combination with ROTAMs for remote configurable ad drops.
They have money, they have ROTAMs. That's an important attribute to add there. If they've got money, they'll have ROTAMs in those locations.
Which that goes into the, you know, whole DWDM, and I think we could spend an entire stand-up just talking about DWDM and the intricacies of that. You know, an OEO gives you the ability. There's also in a true transponder, you have an ingress and an egress, optic in there. Ingress will be matched whatever you're doing for service handoff to the customer, whether that be like 1310, single mode Ethernet, or whether that be a fiber channel, whatever that is. And then you usually have an optic tailored towards your OTN side of the network, so your DWDM channelization. There was also a lot of muxponders, which we started to see, early when 10 gigabit came out, you had a lot of muxponders that could take multiple 1 gig circuits and then light a single 10 gig DWDM wave. It's not doing a standard switch buffering or anything like that. It really is just muxing together all of the bits that are being processed through that. Another component that OEO provides is the ability to do timing and resynchronization. of your optical network. So you will strategically place those in order to, in essence, regenerate your signal and timing with inside your DWDM signal. With the push to 100 gig and beyond with coherent optics, we're able to stretch the distance that you can go before you have to retime and resync it. So in those cases, you just have mid-span amplifiers, which function in the optical domain. So we don't have to convert it back to electrical in order to amplify those signals. And those are usually done through your EDFAs or iridium doped fiber amplifiers. And so that happens on that side. So OEOs in terms of those midpoint regions have becoming less and less because of the new 100 gig coherent optics, which is also why, rural broadband in the US has become so problematic, is you have all these big national carriers that are doing these, long haul DWDM networks, and they're not wanting to spend the money to put ROADMs in or additional OEO drop offs. And so, with coherent optics, you can go 1,000, 2,000 kilometers without ever having to do an OEO or to do a resync and timing on that. All you're doing is, every 80 kilometers or so, you're dropping in an optical amplifier to regen that cycle. So, as I like to call it, we have high speed autobahns crisscrossing our nation with no on ramps and no off ramps. And so it's really difficult for these rural communities to get on, to get any service there. And they're like, okay, hey, well, yeah, we'll give you a 1 gig circuit, but it's going to be, $5,000-$10,000 a month to hop onto this. And it's like, you've got 400 gigs of capacity passing straight by my community. Why is it so cost prohibitive? But that's just the architecture of some of these new designs that they have, is that they don't need to have OEOs to retime and resync their traffic.
You just hit an entire show there.
Yeah.
You hit an entire show there where everybody's running around right now saying, hey, let me build a middle mile network for you. And the answer is, well, where does it go? Hmm. I mean, if it just sits in this region, it doesn't matter. It has to get to one of these places where the major networks are coming together. And I mean, I'm seeing a lot of those types of issues.
Yeah, that's a really important fact there, right? So we have a lack of, there is a lack of middle mile. There's a lot of long haul. There's a lack of middle mile, but there's also the problem of where does the middle mile drop, right? Because you have to get to one of these locations where you can, make a connection. You want to get to a carrier hotel or a place with a really good exchange, at the very least, right? Because otherwise you're still going to be saddled with extremely high transit costs because it's remote. And so you want your middle mile to drop off at a major metropolitan area somewhere, at least one, right? And then basically have an ad drop every opportunity along the way. I mean, there's a lot of money to be made in that space if someone were to do it, but it's a long game, right? Yeah. Like I know of a local provider here that is very, very savvy about this. They essentially build... and I'm sure they're not the only ones. They build fiber for cell towers, but as they pass along all the small towns, because there's a lot of rural cell towers going in, they just fiber to the home, the small towns, because there's literally no alternative, right? If they're really lucky, they might have, a regional or a local WISP, in which case this regional is probably the provider for, and they don't go compete with their own customers, right? So they don't do it. But in many cases, they'll just fiber to the home, all these little towns along the way. And these are small towns, 500 people or whatever, but they've got a captive market at that point. It's a smart business play, really, if you're planning to be around for any period of time.
Yeah, and I think the hard thing for like a lot of WISPs or small ISPs that are trying to get into those arenas, they'll see, Cumin has fiber running right through my town, right? Or whatever ISP has fiber right here. Like, why can't they just, sell me some, 50 miles to the closest city? But one thing that a lot of folks don't understand is when they break apart those strands, they're breaking it apart for the other half too, which might go all the way from, Chicago to Denver. And so you have to basically pay them for that opportunity cost that's lost. And I think a lot of folks definitely don't get that. So even if you can get into that span where there's not an ad drop, it can still be prohibitively expensive.
I think that's true to a certain extent. I mean, I know that because when you put fiber in the ground, it's not like you're putting like, I'm going to put like two pairs of fiber you know, it's going to be a 288 or a 144 or whatever. So there's, you may
not always
get,
true. That's not always true. Well, a lot of people, not always, I mean, there are people I've actually seen places where people get upset with each other, and I've seen departments of transportation pop up and say, well, we're only going to put four strands in here because if we put anything more, people are going to ask us to use it.
Yeah, it really depends. And it's really frustrating that like there's so much that goes into this. And it's not as simple as just like there's fiber that runs through here. And that was the thing when I was in the WISP space. I always saw there was always like, you know, one of the owners of the companies or whatever was always like, you know, oh, there's fiber right there, but they just won't let me have it. It's like, well, there's so much more complexity to it. And a lot of the times it is the provider's fault. Like they're just being obtuse or whatever. But yeah, it is interesting to me all of the various politicking that can go on behind the scenes on all that stuff.
I don't know. I've never seen anything as small as like two pair of fiber for any distance. I mean, I've seen it like in metro areas where it's like two buildings connected together and they do it really, you know, on the cheap because it's just theirs. But you're right. There's a lot of complexity because even if you're going to use a whole new pair, right? So you say you have one pair that's lit and you have however much capacity on that and you're selling off that, but you have to break it out. Even if you're going to break out a whole new pair, that's essentially a whole new installation for the entire path, right? You can't just say, oh, I'll just use another pair, right? Because if it's far enough, you still have to amplify that pair. You still have to have, you know, your transponders on either side. So I guess you're right, but it frustrates me that we have this problem.
It is frustrating. And what I was getting at was like, if you do have if you do have to have amplification on the far side or on like the, if you, so like, okay, let's take this imaginary span between like, let's say Kansas City and Chicago. And, you know, you're doing it from, let's say here in Champaign-Urbana, let's say you need to amplify one time in the middle. What their limiting factor in the huts along the way is how many amplifiers they can fit in. And so if they put one amp for you there on the hut in between here and there, well, that means they can't really put any amps on the far side for you on the, like the Kansas City to Champaign, which I know is not even a run, but whatever, like they can't sell amps on that because they can't go all the way to Chicago because they've now sold that slot. So I guess that's kind of the specific example I'm trying to give there.
The Western swing, it goes to Decatur and Peoria.
Yeah. It's like, there's no fiber span that makes that route, but okay.
Well, and fiber, I think this is where, power. Well, and I think this goes into just network design in general, because with a lot of those paths, they seem to be kind of like, you know, single link. It's like, you know, what happened to the days of the fiber rings that we had built in, so that you've got dual path, even whether that's electronically, building in those mid-span points where you can add drop. And especially with some of the newer ROADMs that we're seeing that can actually do built-in power correction, because that's ultimately one of the hardest things when you're doing mid-span add drops is balancing your power, because you at that point you're injecting a new signal into the DWDM mux pair that, you know, you're going to have different wavelengths at different transmit powers. And so you're trying to calculate that so that you're not blinding your EDFAs, so sending them too hot of a signal that it blinds them and they can't amplify it correctly, or that you're completely destroying your OSNR, because you're trying to launch out of your EDFAs at too high of a power, which, you know, is a very common thing that can happen. And so, you know, there was kind of this big push to adding VOAs into it to where you can, you know, add variable optical amplifiers to attenuate that on it. And then, you know, unfortunately, the failure rates of those have been creeping up more and more, so that people are now backing that off. But then now they're actually adding power correction into the ROADMs. So as you add and remove waves, they will see the incoming power and then adjust on the optical side. The inbound one, and they're seeing better reliability with inside the ROADMs for that versus, you know, keeping that attenuation external. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of considerations with inside the network design and architecture. But, you know, there just does need to be that forethought with, rural communities in mind. Hey, you know, they're, you know, they need broadband just like everybody else does. And, you know, especially with a lot of the infrastructure bills that we have coming out from, the federal government, NTIA, for rural broadband, you know, I'm just hoping that we get more tangible product out of it than we've seen in a lot of communities that came out of the CAF-1, CAF-2, and RDOF funding. You know, that reverse auction process is just a terrible design. in terms of, you know, who can do it for cheaper. And then the penalties if you fail to meet the requirements don't meet the funding that they're getting. So, you know, there's no benefit to actually completing the projects on time. And so who hurt, I mean, and the people that are hurt in the end are the communities that are continuing to be underserved through these projects. And there was one more thing before try to wrap up here, kind of circling back to what we were talking about MACSEC, because I'm pretty sure we could have an entire another stand up on OT and stuff. But one thing that we're also additionally testing, we're seeing more providers doing VXLAN to the edge and extensions across that. And so that is another thing that I'm also looking from a layer two transparent perspective, is looking at some of the VXLAN and what we can do across that, specifically MACSEC being one in this case, but then other just standard layer two multicast type protocols across the VXLAN, since we're seeing that heavy in the data center, and I'm seeing more providers deploying VXLAN SD-WAN devices out to the customers. So
that makes sense. And I think you really touched on a point of why some of this stuff is so complex, right? Because for those that are used to working with fiber, but not familiar with, you know, wave division multiplexing, usually you don't even think about the power, right? You only really think about the optical power if your link isn't coming up, right? You might know the commands on your switching gear, your routing gear, to look at the optical power received and the optical power transmitted out of your physical optic. But when you're doing wave division multiplexing, you have essentially an optical budget to work with. And as you alluded to, you've got different power levels on different wavelengths, and you have to work all of those within the budget that you currently have. Now, when I learned, you know, basically you had a tray, you know, it's like a filter bank, essentially. So you'd plumb in your wavelengths to whatever frequency you wanted them in. And if they were too hot, you'd add a physical attenuator to them so that, you know, when you went to read it, it wasn't doing what you said, you know, burning out the path along the way. And you had to constantly like scope and measure power until you got it right. And then you just never touched it until there was a fiber cut or you had to change something. Now, a lot of that stuff's built in, but I guess the point I'm trying to make is it isn't as simple as I have this fiber and I'm just going to like put service on it, right? We get really spoiled by that in, you know, in the router space or the data center space, where we're not having to really worry about. I mean, I've seen places that don't even own a fiber scope or a cleat top. They just, oh, well, it's good enough, right? Click, there it goes. It could be filthy, but it'll probably still work because it's all, at the very most, it's plugging into some metro gear that gets it somewhere else.
Exactly. I mean, and legacy OTN networks, especially, you know, let's say 10 gig, up to about 10 gigs, you also had things to consider like dispersion compensation that ran through the fiber, as well as your OSNR on the other side to ensure that your eye, you know, is appropriately sized so that the optic can understand the incoming bits. With the move to 100 gig, 200 gig, 400 gig coherent optics, you know, all of that is kind of being built into the optics. Which then just further increases the cost to midspan cut into that circuit, because now you're only operating at 100 gig wavelength and, you know, 100 gig and above. You know, some of these rural communities, if they could just get a 10 gig surface, it would be 100 times better than what they currently have. And, you know, that makes it harder to build those in. And so that's, you know, one of the big design considerations that I have to do with these networks is, am I going to build to have the ability to drop off 10 gig waves, whether that be DWDM waves or just a switched Ethernet 10 gig circuit, or am I going to stick to just 100 or higher? Because it changes the design and the modeling of the network, and especially in the equipment that we place in those, which direction we decide to go with that. You know, typically, though, you can still run 100, 200, 400 gig on a legacy network designed for 10 gig, but the converse doesn't occur. You can't run a 10 gig DWDM wave on a network just designed for coherent optics, as you will not have appropriate dispersion in OSNR calculations into that. So, you know, there's definitely a lot. It's ever changing. I think it's simplifying down to the engineer's level to be able to do a lot more with that. But I think, you know, there's still going to be a lot of that work that's coming from, you know, vendors, and every vendor is going to have their different topology. And there's really no standardization between them on a lot of this too. So it makes it even that more difficult to where, you know, you too end up getting a little bit more vendor locked on the OTN side of things with it. And so, you know, we're hoping to, and working with a lot of different vendors to try to, you know, get some interop testing and equipment so that we're not necessarily tied in, and definitely breaking our route switch layer from our OTN layer so that we're not, you know, because historically in this market, we've all seen companies get acquired and then product lines disappear. And they're like, well, we really don't have anything to replace it. We're just going to can the whole line. And so it makes things a lot more difficult for some of these systems to continue to operate at a cost-effective manner once they get built. So sustainability is always a big thing.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, I think we're running up on the edge of our time here. This is just a short one, little stop and chat. Good Nick, as you are now upgraded to, we appreciate having you on, man. Do you have any social media presence, or, you know?
I tend to avoid social media.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
I think at this point, just on Slack, pop in a few other Slack channels if the needs arise.
All right, hiding around in the Slacker nets, and Mr. Osman.
What about me? We've always got trying to find me. Go john@osman.net is always easy. Miscreantsinaction.net or .com. I can't remember what it is now.
Such a great blog. I love it so much.
There's not much there, but I'm glad you enjoy it.
But the stuff that's on there is good.
Aside from that, I got a feeling if you come to Albuquerque, Nick and I will both find you and take you for beer. So come on down.
Cool. Raleigh.
Boy, we did cover two topics, mostly due to my rambling, which I'm okay with. But I'm around. I'm on a couple Slacks and, you know, Twitter at @forwardingplane and forwardingplane.net blog. I'm not that hard to find. LinkedIn.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I'm Chris Cummings, CrankyNetMan on Twitter, /64.tech. And on the various Slack groups. And of course, you can always find me on modem.show whenever we actually post something. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for tuning into the Modem Podcast, where yesterday's modems are today's transponders. For more information or to request a topic, please visit modem.show.